You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. It is February 12th while we record this. And it's pretty out there, Don.
I woke up to bright, sunny skies. I'm a little further west than you are, and now there's cloud cover here where we are. The temperature in the West Sacramento area, according to the Weather Service, you never know when you click on National Weather Service exactly which station you're going to go to. This one is pulling from West Sacramento, where it is 39 degrees right now. We were freezing this morning. Again, we've had a number of frosty mornings in February and in January this year. And we've got some changes in the weather. We had a couple inches of rain a week ago. Now we have a flood warning. I love this. We have a flood warning, a wind advisory, and a flood watch all lined up on the National Weather Service page. The flood warning will already be in that by the time this broadcasts on February 13th. We've got a storm coming in. It's partly sunny today with a high of only 54 degrees, and the low tonight is going to be 46, so much warmer night temperature with 100% chance of showers. And then Thursday, the day of the broadcast, 100% chance of showers and breezy. And when they say breezy, they're talking about, gusts up to 18 to 23 miles an hour, even as high as 41. So I consider that windy, not breezy. But, you know, I suppose if you're a meteorologist, that seems just breezy. And then on Thursday night, we'll have 100% chance of showers, and we're only going to get down to about 48 degrees. Friday, showers are likely, but clearing out. 60 degrees is going to be the high on Friday. Friday night, partly cloudy, getting cold again, 41 degrees. Saturday, mostly cloudy, but there will be gaps in the cloud. We'll see some sunshine, and the high is only going to be 57 degrees. Saturday night, 44 degrees and mostly cloudy. That's going to be kind of the break, and then there's a weak storm lined up for late Sunday into Monday, Washington's birthday. I guess that's a holiday for some people. Sunday is a chance of showers, 58 degrees. Sunday night, a slight chance of showers, 44 degrees. Monday, Washington's birthday, slight chance of showers, partly sunny, bumping up to 61 degrees. Monday night, partly cloudy, 41. And Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high near 62 degrees. What's the extended forecast? We can have a little break in all this off and on rain and frost. Well, the ensemble guidance, as they say, which is just merging all the models. By Sunday morning, another weather system will push its wave through Northern California, much weaker than the midweek storm that will be retrospective at that point. And there'll be little to no impacts expected from the weekend storm, just some dusting of snow, light showers, locally breezy winds. Monday, any lingering precipitation tapers off, a return to drier and slightly warmer weather continues into Tuesday. So we've had couple inches of rain in the last week or so. The soil is nice and loose for pulling weeds. I would strongly suggest you get out and do that if you possibly can, because it's a great time to pull out all those weeds that we talk about. Bed straw, it's in its flowering stage now, folks. If you move fast, you can prevent problems for next year. A lot of the grasses are beginning to move into their reproductive phase, which means beginning to grow more upright. Start putting out flowers and perhaps seeds, and they're a lot easier to pull right now. So whether you're had a conversation with a gentleman yesterday, his whole backyard is weeds. He brought in, to his credit, samples. Really good idea. Because if you just walk in and say to me, I got a lot of weeds, what do I do about them? I can tell you what my first question is going to be.
What are they?
Yes. What are they? And they'll go, I need to know what they are. Well, that'll tell us your best strategy for getting rid of them. And in his case, they were mostly annual things that I think he could probably just mow or take a weed whacker to, do that a couple times, and he'd probably get pretty good control. But if you have a lot of these winter annual grassy weeds, you probably know from experience now that if you just mow them, they just push right back up and they go back into bloom. So to control oats or foxtails, that's an important one. Those types of grassy weeds, you'd have to mow them 3 to 4 times to probably get control. Whereas one tug, they pull out pretty easily, or a little chop with a hoe right below the, right down there at ground level, you'll get control with one visit to that little patch of weeds. Well, in his case, it was a big patch of weeds. So I suggested going and getting a mower, mowing them short, and mulching the heck out of his yard. He should get chipdrop.net. Or, you know, the thing we do here, put a tarp over it for a while. Right now is about the time that I'm ready to drag out my 25 by 100 foot tarp, roll it out with the help of a couple of people, weight it down because we get a lot of wind out here, put it right over those weeds that are growing and beginning to go into reproductive phase, leave it on there for about 6 to 8 weeks, and it's perfect for planting those summer vegetables. So if you just want to use a simple mechanical method of controlling weeds and it won't disturb your homeowners association or your neighbors, consider a tarp. It works really well. Yeah.
I wanted to back up to one of the very first things you said when you talked about weather, flood watch, flood warning, flood whatever. So when I first saw that, it was like blue skies. It was sunshine. A couple of days ago, I said, well, what is this flood thing? I went and I looked it up. What is happening is that there is rain elsewhere and the water is running down past us. So some of the creeks, some of the little rivers are, you know, having problems. But for us in Davis, the big thing is, have you been to Sacramento over the causeway?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. The waters are lapping the bridge almost. I mean, I've only once seen it this high.
Yeah.
And so we have a flood watch, but it's not for my yard.
Right. Right now, if you drive over Pewter Creek, which the Interstate 80 goes over, it's the property line between Yolo and Solano counties. And there's two places where you can do it. Interstate 80 goes over it and Pedrick Road or Road 98 goes over it. And it is full to the edges. It is full over the paths. It is full over the visitor areas, you know, the tables. It is the Lake Berryessa Glory Hole, as they call it, has been overflowing now for a week. And that means a whole lot of water is running down through Pewter Creek, and it is full as it is supposed to be. It looks absolutely great. And there's going to be a lot of nice vegetation along there. The salmon numbers, you may not know that there are salmon that actually do swim up and spawn in Pewter Creek. Fairly new phenomenon, or a restored phenomenon, I guess is the best way to put it. They're down, but they're present. They are there. And this kind of water running through there is great for the wildlife all down that riparian corridor. So it's great to see Pewter Creek full again. I think the last time it was at this level was 5 or 6 years ago, which was the last time that particular drain plug overflowed. As we mentioned last week, this is a big deal when it happens. People drive up there to take pictures of it. It's really interesting to look at. It's like a giant bathtub drain on a lake. And there's a couple others around the world that have this, but it's kind of an unusual phenomenon. But the main thing is it means there's relatively controlled flows of water coming down and filling up the creek, and great for that whole riparian corridor. We have some events coming up.
Well, first I want to say that this is February 12th and we are recording this for broadcast on February 13th, because I don't think we said that. Coming up on February 22nd and 23rd, 10 days from now, it's going to be the 110th annual Almond Festival. What?
Almond? Or you can say Almond Festival.
Well, you know the difference between almonds and almonds.
Yes. When I came here to go to college and I was taking my plant science 2 class in agricultural, whatever it was, and the professor, any of you out there in Davis, remember Dr. Flocker? He said, well, they call them almonds because when they shake them off the tree, it shakes the L out of them. Okay. We only promise to do that. We promise only to do that joke once.
It is such an old joke.
Yes, it is a very old joke. Okay. It's coming up. What's the date?
Okay. The history of the Almond Festival. This is up in Esparto, which is up the Cape Hay Valley a little ways. It says the inaugural Almond Festival took place in October of 1915, honoring almond harvest. This two-day celebration began with a parade on Saturday, followed by a variety of traditional festival
activities
on Sunday. The homecoming queen was crowned as the Almond Queen, taking center stage during the parade. The festival was temporarily suspended during World War II, likely to conserve resources. It wasn't until 1964 that the newly established Chamber of Commerce rejuvenated the event, relocating it to the last Sunday in February. Since then, we have continued to commemorate the almond blossom at the Almond Festival. So, February 22nd and 23rd, and look for more information. We'll probably talk about this again.
Someone asked me after I wrote a column about some of the historical orchards in this area and how long they've been. They said, how long have they been growing almonds here, really? And I said, starting in the 1870s, the first almonds were planted in this area. And that's where the best known variety, Nonpareil, Nonpareil is the way we would pronounce it if we'd taken high school French, was created by an almond grower way back in the 1870s. It is still the number one variety planted. Almonds were just one of a number of tree crops that were planted around the Quépe Valley and also over here in the Winters area. Plums were big, apricots. So there's been a tree crop industry in this area now for, that's 150 something years, which is pretty impressive. Just in the time I've been here, I've watched some varieties come and go. There used to be thousands of acres of pears around here. There's almost no acreage in pears. And the most common question I'm getting from folks who just know that I happen to be involved in orcharding stuff is, what's going on with all the orchards? I said, what's going on is walnuts are being taken out like crazy. As we've mentioned on this show, a number of walnut orchards, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres of walnut orchards are being removed in this area because the price per pound simply dropped way below anything that would make it possible for them to make a profit. And another one is going out as we speak, right around the corner from me. So that is 13 walnut orchards, each 200 to 300 acres just in my area that have been taken out in the last 2 years. Almonds are coming out to some degree, but it's because of age. Heavy plantings of almond orchards in the 1980s. Those orchards are well past their prime, 1990s, even into about 2000. An almond orchard lasts 25 to 30 years. Walnut orchard usually 30 to 40 years. And they take them out and either replant them with the same crop again, because the trees have gotten old. They're just starting over. Sometimes you'll see them interplanting an orchard with new trees to just rejuvenate it that way. Sometimes they rip the whole thing out and plant a new orchard. But you know what they're doing now? They're ripping out the orchards and they're planting row crops. So we're seeing significant changeover in the acreage locally from tree crops to sunflowers. That's cool. Canning tomatoes and certain other row crops in the area. You're going to see some pretty significant differences in the landscape around both Solano and Yolo counties because of cropping changes, aging out of old orchards, and market changes.
Sharon from Tracy writes to us. And before I read this, I want to tell you about something she refers to as the Bird Buddy bird feeder. Now, Bird Buddy is a brand. And the Bird Buddy has a camera in it. So when you put your bird feeder out, you get to watch the birds that come to it. So that's the thing is.
Bird Buddy?
Bird Buddy, yes.
Bird Buddy bird feeder. Got it.
Yeah. Hi, Don and Lois. Thank you so much for all of your awesome advice regarding growing fruit in our shady backyard. We bought alpine strawberry seeds and are hoping to get a bear slime and a plum tree as well.
There you go.
Lois asked for information regarding the squirrel baffle on our Bird Buddy bird feeder. See photo attached. I love when people send photos. It's so nice. It is the quote APS squirrel baffle, unquote, from Wild Birds Unlimited in Sacramento, which, by the way, is one of my favorite stores.
Oh, yes.
The kind employee there recommended the baffle after a rat kept triggering the camera on our Bird Buddy. So far, the rat hasn't gotten to the feeder, but neither have those cute scrub jays that we used to see. I'm not sure the scrub jays or the rat know the bird feeder still exists. We did relocate the feeder to the middle of the yard after installing the baffle. Apparently, the baffle is useless if feeders are too close to anything that a rat or squirrel can jump from. I decorated the Bird Buddy with leftover pine branches now to see if that would make the birds feel less exposed. No luck so far. Thanks again. I love the show and lovely photos of this. This squirrel baffle is really amazing. It's on a pole. It's like a cone pointed down. So if something crawls up the pole, at some point it can't go anywhere. So
I
have gotten myself a bird buddy. I haven't put it up yet.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking I should get one of these squirrel baffles.
Well, let's talk briefly about scrub jays, because to me, they're actually a very important part of your garden pest control. Scrub jays and mockingbirds are very, very active on my farm. I have mentioned before, magpies were really big here when we first moved here. There are hundreds of magpies in the area. They died out because of West Nile virus and basically were gone from my property for a good 10, 15 years. They're slowly rebuilding. But as they went away, we noticed a steady increase in the populations of both mockingbirds and scrub jays, which fill a similar niche. It's not identical, but in the garden, they certainly seem to fill a similar niche. And I have observed both of those species, mockingbirds and jays, going through the garden, hopping in, landing on a tomato cage, going into the tomato, and I would sit there and watch very patiently and watch them come out with a stink bug in their mouth and fly off to the next tomato cage and land on that one and go into that tomato. And I know they're giving a significant level of control of leaf-footed bugs, stink bugs, a variety of other pests that are bigger than you would think of for control by a beneficial organism. In other words, we're always talking about what eats your aphids, what eats, the scale. These are eating the big bugs that can be quite a nuisance. And I know that what brought them onto our property, aside from the fact that the niche became available, was that I had planted things like mulberries, for fruit, and they eat way more fruit than anybody could possibly eat. But the scrub jays and the mockingbirds go into those trees and certainly seem to be enjoying the fruit to some degree. And then they move from there into the vegetable garden and they go through the vegetable, or maybe they're just in the mulberries because they're dense and they like the cover, or there's bugs in there. That's also possible.
There's bugs in there because mockingbirds and jays, if they eat any fruit at all, eat very little.
By accident.
The jays really are, they like nuts, they like bugs, they like, whatever.
Yeah, no shortage of nuts for them. That's something I'm definitely providing, but they like the cover that these mulberries provide.
And the mockingbirds might go to, a pomegranate or something like that, or they might get the berries on the toyon, but they're not really going after fruit very much.
Correct. Okay.
So they're looking for bugs.
So they are very happily on the pomegranates, probably because that's one of the most common places you find leaf-footed bugs is on pomegranates. That's where they like to overwinter. And they don't do a lot of damage to the pomegranates. You'll often find disturbing numbers of them just right on one fruit. So how would you encourage jays and mockingbirds? I think, don't they land... They have big feet. They're not going to land on a normal little bird feeder.
Maybe. I don't know. Jays will go to regular bird feeders. Okay. To encourage jays, you want big seeds. Now, I'm always telling you to use those chopped sunflower seeds. That's what the little birds love, and it don't have much waste, and there's very little mess and all that. But if you want our scrub jays, they'll come, they'll land, they'll pick one up and go, are you really kidding? I need something more than this. So peanuts, with or without the shell, peanuts are good. Mm-hmm. Cashews, unsalted, unroasted, just plain old.
Cashews for your scrub jays. Got it.
something bigger.
I can tell you what they eat in large numbers. Pecans.
Bugs.
Pecans. They are very fond of pecans. they are in fact a major pest problem on pecan orchards in Georgia and other places where pecans are grown commercially. And I've watched this on my 85 pecan trees. As the walnut harvest ends nearby us, they finish and all the birds just love that because there's crushed nuts on the ground and things like that. Then they're all done. It's all picked up. It's all swept up. So they all move over to my pecan orchard, which is the only one in the area. And you can watch the birds up there knock the pecans down to the ground, where then it becomes a three-way fight between them, the ground squirrels, and the turkeys. And if I'm lucky, I get a few of them. So it's a good, rich food source for birds. Anyway.
So one of the things that's an interesting side note is if you have oaks, you'll probably have some kind of jay.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about this, different areas of the world, there are lots of different oaks around. Mm-hmm. But most places, if there's an oak, there's a jay. So
Yeah, they're definitely following the acorn production on my property as well. So it's good to know that you're encouraging them. It is probably moving the feeder out into the yard that made a difference, because there's no cover for them to conveniently get there from. I'll bet they'll find it.
I'm sure they'll find it.
Yeah.
The jays aren't going to have a trouble with being out in the world. She did raise it up like 8 feet off the ground. So that makes a difference too. Some of the smaller birds, like the ones who are here in winter, like the white-crowned sparrows, golden-crowned sparrows, mm-hmm. juncos, mm-hmm. they wouldn't really like to be 8 feet off the ground. So you're probably not going to get as many of them, but you'll get other things. You'll get, you know, finches.
No, my suggestion is that she do an experiment and get a second feeder and put it 4 feet above the ground, and then put the camera up so we can see which birds go to which one. And please give us a report on that.
To buy a whole nother
feeder
bird buddy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for the letter. We appreciate that. We think birds are a very important part of your landscape, your pest control, and so encouraging them in any way you possibly can, which sometimes means you have to tolerate some fruit or, you know, vegetable damage, but that's okay. That we're gardening not just for ourselves, right? We're gardening for wildlife. Sometimes it feels like that's all we're doing.
Okay, here's another question. This is from Kathy and Davis. I have a houseplant question. I have a very tall ficus. This is the title is Root Cuttings of Fiddle Leaf Fig? Mm-hmm. So I have a very tall ficus, and there are two stems coming out of the soil. It's branched underground, with the shorter stem being about 4 feet tall and having two heads. The taller stem is about 8 feet tall and has a side shoot at about 2 feet from the ground. I would like to shorten this plant. Here's the questions. One, if I cut off the tall stem just above its side shoot, will the side shoot live?
The side shoot will live, yes. Okay, that was an easy one.
Two, can I root the cutoff part? If so, how would I do that?
Okay, there is the tricky part. When I worked in the Botanical Conservatory, we would attempt to root ficus, and they would frustrate the heck out of us. We would take a cutting, and everything was fine. Now, remember, we had warm benches, mist benches, greenhouses at a certain temperature, greenhouses at a different temperature. So we had every possible option. We would root them. We would dip them in a hormone. That's real important. And they would callus, which is what you see if you pull the cutting out too early and you look at it, you'll see cell growth already happening at the base of the cutting. That's the it looks like callus tissue, but it's a proliferation of cells beginning. And from that, hopefully at some point comes roots, and we would check them. And weeks and weeks and weeks would go by, and the cutting would look fine. This is the funny part. It would just look perfectly fine, as if it was rooting. 2 months in, we'd pull it up, no roots. 3 months in, we'd pull it up. Sometimes it would take 6 to 9 months to root. Usually, before that would happen, it was just unable to take up moisture at sufficient rate to support the leaves that were up there, and they would wither and fall off, and the cutting would fail. Because remember, every cutting is a race against time for the ability of the plant to take up enough water to support the foliage that was up there when you took the cutting. With very big leafed plants, we would sometimes cut the leaves in half, so that we would reduce the water loss through the leaves to try to give ourselves a little bit of a hedge on that race against time. And that would sometimes work, but they were very slow, very difficult, and very low percentage rate from cuttings. So my answer there is I certainly wouldn't promise that it's going to root, but it's certainly worth a try. However, if you don't want to take that risk, you could try air layering it. Air layering is something that's actually pretty easy to do, which is where you just take sphagnum moss or something like it, and you wrap it around the stem somewhere. And you can even buy these cute little clip-on plastic devices that hold that in place. You just clip them on the stem around the moss. You can find all kinds of YouTube videos and illustrations of how to do air layering. And you put that on there and you keep that moist. So you got to keep it moist, but not soggy. So you've got to have some way of moistening that moss, like spritz a little water on it every now and then so that it doesn't dry out. And your hope is that the plant will root right into the moss. Sometimes people actually take a razor blade and make a very slight slit in the stem right below the growth bud that you're putting this around, because that will sometimes block the flow of hormones from above, and which is suppressing the growth of roots and allow the plant to put out roots. Sometimes this works, but more to the point, if it doesn't, you still have your plant. You haven't lost anything. Frequently it roots, and this is true of Dracaenas and a lot of other houseplants. Air layering is a safer way to work to go if you only have one plant and only have one cutting to take, because you're not risking the appearance of your entire plant. You're just taking a chance that it might or might not root. So air layering is what I would look into as a possible option. Cuttings of ficus, one of the things about fiddle leaf fig, they drop leaves, they get leggy. We all know this. They have all kinds of issues. One of the reasons I've stopped selling them is because so many things go wrong with fiddle leaf fig, and they're slow to propagate and have a pretty low success rate. So I'm not trying to discourage you from trying this, but I would think air layering might be a better option than chopping it off and taking a gamble that that cutting may or may not work. Lois is now looking at her fiddle leaf fig across the room, thinking about how she wants to do this. So Lois has a fiddle leaf fig in her study or living room, whatever this is. It's about 14 feet tall and appears to be sprawling across the room. I would try air layering that, Lois.
Well, I don't really want it. I don't want that long stem to be there.
Then cut it off.
It's too big.
It's absolutely fine to cut it off. You can prune ficus almost any way you want to. But bear in mind, as important to note for anyone who hasn't grown a ficus, when you cut them, white latex comes out and drips, and it doesn't come off of surfaces. So be sure to put something down when you first cut them.
Okay. So last question on this, this fiddle leaf fig is, the stem is covered with little brown remnants of leaves, little scale kinds of things, you know, little papery things.
Bud scales.
How in the world, it's not an insect, it's part of the plant.
Right.
How would I find a bud in all that mess?
It doesn't really matter. You'll see a scar where a leaf was. So there's always a scar at the base of where a leaf was present, and there's always a growth bud above where the leaf was present, and there's the potential for root initiation below where the leaf was.
So
that's all you need to know with any plant, pretty much, is that it has the capability of producing, here's a vocabulary word, adventitious roots. Roots. Those are roots which form in places where, let's just say, they're unexpected. They're unlike seedling roots. Adventitious roots can form at a node. A node is where a leaf was. Above the leaf node is a growing bud, that, or the potential for a bud. Sometimes they remain for many, many, many years on some species. Other times they just lose viability very quickly. So some plants, if you cut them back hard, they resprout right away. If you ever tried to get rid of a privet, you know that, you know, they're just going to resprout when you cut them down. Other plants, those growth buds fizzle out within a year or two. They lose their viability, or they get completely covered with those bud scales and then with woody, corky covering, and they're not capable of growing. Juniper is a good example. If you ever want to kill most junipers, all you got to do is take a chainsaw, cut them off at the ground level. They will not resprout. You're done. Your project is over. If you want to kill a privet, you cut it off at ground level, and either you treat it with a chemical or you cut it off at ground level year after year after year until it finally loses energy. The ficus has a pretty visible point where the leaf was attached, because they're a large petiole, the petiole being the part that holds the leaf. So you can usually see that scar quite clearly. Right above that, you can often even see the bud that wants to grow. It may be very, very reduced, but it's usually visibly present. You won't see the root initials on most plants, but there are some cool houseplant exceptions to that. Pretty much everything in the philodendron family, the root initial is there ready to go. If you've got a pothos, or a philodendron cordatum, or a monstera, they will just start growing right out into the air. So you can see those roots. That's one of the reasons we like to use those houseplants when we're showing, oh, a new intern, for example, that's working at our nursery, or a kid who's got an interest in plants. I can show them, here, take this 6-inch piece of pothos, see that, that's a root, put it in water, you can watch it grow, put it in soil, it'll grow very happily, now you have a new plant. So on some plants, they're very visible and obvious. Other plants like ficus, they may not even be present, and there may certainly may not be visible, but there's potential. This is one of the reasons we do the hormone dip, which is a powder that you dip them into, is that will often trigger them to grow. So that just enhances your root growth. It enhances the likelihood of root growth. Let's put it that way. Now, you often ask me what I'm seeing in my garden, what I'm enjoying, what I'm doing. What's going on in your garden landscape or with your houseplants right now, Lois?
Okay, so you know I love xylosma. They're wonderful. And a few years ago, I had a neighbor, I ended up cutting down my xylosma in front to 8 feet, and they're growing back wonderfully. I looked up my backyard and realized that I hadn't done anything with the xylosma hedge in on the back fence for years. Usually I cut it down to a reasonable height. And so I got some people to come over. The things were at least 16 feet tall, maybe taller. And I said, cut them down at 8 feet. So I now have, well, he was very good and very conscientious. And he knew that I liked hummingbird landing spots and I liked to see a little greenery. So he went up just a little over 8 feet to make sure that I had a few branches with leaves still on them. Right. So I now have total sunshine. I mean, I used to have total shade. Now I've got sunshine everywhere.
It's a nice thing to have happening in the winter, have sunlight coming through a window. Yeah. And we get that actually is a question we keep getting. Is it okay to prune, fill in the blank right now? Or what is time to prune, fill in the blank? And so the key principle, I had someone who was trying to like go through their plants in their yard one by one. And I said, let's just back up here and talk globally. The key principle is if it's even subtropical at all, if it's tropical, well, it's toast. We got too cold for it the other day. So just don't do anything. Just wait. That's one. We'll come back to that one. If it's subtropical, bougainvilleas, young citrus, certain types of citrus, fuchsias. I'm sure I could think of several other things in this category, especially this year when we've had some pretty cold nights. You don't prune when there's a risk of continued cold weather. So we don't prune in January or February, even if they got frosted back more than usual. Lantana being a really good example, it always gets leaves blackened here. And it's just a matter of how far back the injury occurs as to where you cut them back to. But we have the potential for frost all through February. Middle of February is kind of when it really the chances start dropping rapidly. But I have pictures of frost at the end of February, early March. I even have a picture of frost in early April, but that was a light sparkly thing that was sufficiently weird that I took a picture of it in terms of risk to plants through the month of February. So any of those subtropicals, an easier way to go about it is when they start to grow, look at where they're growing and cut back to that. So your lantana, I've had years on my farm where regular old lantana has been killed to the ground. More commonly, it's, you know, the top quarter of the plant is killed by freezing weather. Well, I wait until the plant tells me it's ready to grow, and then I prune it. If it's a deciduous, hardy thing, we typically prune them in the wintertime because they're dormant, and that's a good time to do it. It's easy to see what you're doing. So it's okay to prune things, obviously, like roses and things of that sort in January because we know that they're essentially dormant. I know some of you out there are saying, my roses never went dormant. I know, this is California, but pretend they did. Okay, but if it's a plant like a xylosmum, and you look it up in the Western Garden Book, and it's hardy to a much colder zone than here, as it is, it can go down into the low 20s, even into the teens, it's perfectly okay to prune an evergreen hardy plant in the winter. You can see what you're doing, you can open it up, enjoy some sunlight coming through, you're not gonna hurt the plant. If you're living in an area where you're, let's say, USDA zone 8 or 7, then you know that some of these broadleaf evergreens, you need to be more careful with them. We're in USDA zone 9. Some of our listeners are in USDA zone 10. You can prune those evergreens like xylosma right now with no problem and get more sunlight through your window to make your houseplants happier.
And when you are pruning a hedge or something like that, remember the growth cycle of your plant. I've just pruned the heck out of these things, but it's February. Yeah. So they're going to start budding and leafing and regrowing this spring. Yeah. But if I had done that in, September or October, it wouldn't have put out new growth because it was in its quiescent period. I learned that from that. So you would end up with ugly stumps showing. Yeah. For a while. So if you got a hedge, February is better.
Wouldn't hurt the plant, but it's going to be unsightly. And so that, and another important thing about hedges, and this is really crucial, if you keep clipping them year after year after year, you'll eventually get just a shell of foliage and the interior of the hedge will die out. So it's actually very important for the longevity of a hedge to thin it lightly every so often. You'll often see, for example, recommendations for a standard hedge, you know, just a wall of privacy between you and your neighbors, to clip it at a slight angle outward as you go down. In other words, make it narrow a bit towards the top. And the purpose of that is to get good sunlight on the whole structure of the hedge so you don't have it dying out down at the base. Another really important part is to just thin it out lightly. And this is hard for people to do because then the hedge doesn't look hedgy. But you need to do this every now and then. I went out and consulted once on a 100-year-old boxwood hedge in the downtown area of Sacramento. It was in the fabulous 40s, if you know Sacramento at all. Lots of charming little cottagey houses, very, very mid-20th century look on all the landscaping. And they had a beautiful boxwood hedge. I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but it was a beautiful, cool little boxwood hedge that went all the way around the front. And it was beginning to die out, because for at least 30, 40 years, they had just been clipping it. And all they had was about 2 inches of foliage, of a shell of foliage around the essentially open interior of the hedge, no foliage on the interior of the hedge. And I said, what you need to start doing now, rather urgently, is get some narrow pruners, bonsai pruners would be ideal, and just go out and start taking little pieces out of that shell so sunlight can get down onto the inside of that hedge, and try to get some of the remaining buds that are down there waiting to grow to go ahead and grow and start replacing and rejuvenating the hedge. Because otherwise, it's going to continue dying out. They're getting to the point where some of the slightly shaded parts of this hedge, the plants were beginning to die, and they had no real way to rejuvenate themselves. I said, your only chance here is to get some sunlight to the interior. So if you've been clipping a hedge year after year after year, you may be creating a long-term problem. There's two ways to deal with that. One is a hard pruning every now and then. You're taking a chance, but it usually works. It looks terrible when you get done. A better approach is just every now and then. You don't have to do this all at once. Make it a little bit of a 15-minute meditative hobby. Go out with your bonsai shears and clip a little bit out here and a little bit out there so a little more sunlight can get to the interior of the hedge. I think Lois has sort of done an in-between here, fairly hard pruning and then opening it up a bit to get some sunlight to the interior. I have little doubt that her xylosma will resprout vigorously and be back up with 3 to 4 feet of growth by the end of this coming summer.
So Don, before I get onto this little next segment, I have a question for you. You keep saying, let sunlight into the interior of something. Mm-hmm. Now, if the something is running east and west, there's light on the sun south, but not on the north.
Correct.
Is it just light, or does it have to be actual sunlight?
Light makes a difference, but a very common issue. When you plant a hedge close to a house and you've got a window behind it, you end up a few years in looking at bare branches from the inside. So if you had carefully thinned the hedge, even where the light is only coming from one direction, you're likelier to have greater density that you'll be seeing from the inside. So the backside, the north side, as you suggest, can thin out pretty badly unless you manage that hedge carefully. There are plants that reshoot from the base. I mean, a really good example, Abelia, which happens to be one of my favorite shrubs, Abelia grandiflora, one I prefer, but there's Edward Goucher, a bunch of new cultivars out there that are variegated, very commonly clipped as a hedge, which is one of my least favorite things to see because it has a lovely growth habit when it's grown more naturally. But if you clip that one constantly, it has an advantage over some of the other things we've talked about. It sends up these new vigorous shoots from the base, and they'll go up and they'll fill those gaps. So it actually makes a great hedge if you happen to want to do that with it. It rejuvenates, it restores itself. If you cut the thing to the ground, it will send up a bunch of shoots right away, and you can allow it to grow more naturally at that point. But the main thing is its growth habit is such that it tends to restore itself. Boxwood, myrtle, euonymus, they don't. They don't restore themselves unless you manage them to do so. So that's really important. The most common hedge plants don't naturally restore themselves. The one that does is privet. And that's why it's so popular. But there's a lot of us that aren't real fond of privet for a bunch of reasons.
So as an emergency solution, what would you think about getting some, grow lights or something shining up into the plant from the bottom, if you've got a hedge that's historical and needs to be saved?
Enhancing the light into the interior of the hedge is the goal. I don't really think grow lights are going to be a practical option for most people, but frequently it's a matter of pruning away a tree so that you get more sunlight in there. If a hedge is getting in a neighborhood where it's getting more and more shade, and then the key is opening up the dense canopy that the plant itself has. But if this is a 200-year-old hedge and it's a historical monument, put a grow light out there.
So, listeners, I have a treat for you. I want to give you a URL. Now, if you're driving, don't write it down, but listen to the show again so you get this. It's important. Instagram.com/don.shore. And that's D-O-N period S-H-O-R.
Hey, that's me.
And if you go there, you will see Don when he posts pictures. And he's got over 1,000 pictures up here. It's really amazing. I'm going to go through a few with you now, just because. So Don, we usually do the calendar, but today I'm gone to your Instagram and I want to ask you about some of the things that you posted up here.
Yeah, and I do. What I do is I just post what appears to be the best picture from my phone that day. That's it.
Okay. There's one that is pink blossoms. It's, I think it's the last one you have. It says Prunus bleria. You say it.
Bleriana, likely you're bleary, B-L-I-R-E-I-A-N-A. This is the flowering plum. And this is one of my favorite flowering trees for a bunch of reasons. One is that it blooms, as you can see, extremely early. It blooms with the almond trees in this area. So it's blooming late January, early February, soft pink double flowers. This plum is fruitless, 100% totally guaranteed to be fruitless. All the other flowering plums are mostly fruitless, and mostly isn't good enough for a lot of people. Prunus bleriana can live 25, 30 years or more, which is pretty long lived for a flowering tree. It seems to be tolerant of heat here in the valley, not particularly drought tolerant. Plums and their ilk are generally not super drought tolerant. Landscape contractors like the red leaf or purple leaf plum, Prunus crowder vesuvius. It is not completely fruitless. It's got a richer color to the foliage, but it is the fruit can be an issue on that one. This Prunus bleriana blooms very early. Flowering plum is, as I say, blooming late January, early February. So one of the best flowering trees for this area. We're losing a lot of flowering cherries around because of the heat. Where there's other flowering trees that have issues like crepe myrtles with the aphid that they get. Very few pest problems on the flowering plum. Prunus bleriana.
Okay. And a week ago, you put in a Shinomales japonica Toyo Nishika. Hey, I got it.
Good job. That's flowering quince.
That's a flowering quince.
Yeah. Shinomale, C-H-A-E-N-O-M-E-L-E-S. Put that in front of someone and ask them to pronounce it. Shinomale is the way it's generally pronounced. Flowering quince. Toyo Nishiki is an interesting, one of my favorite cultivars of the Shinomale or flowering quince. Mine is all pink right now, but it has color breaks all the time, which is a term we use for just a sport in a flower where it's a different color or a stripe or something. So you can have your Toyo Nishiki with red, pink, white, red and pink, red and white, all at the same time, all on the plant at the same time. And again, flowering quince are probably the first of the flowering shrubs and trees to bloom in our area. I took that picture back in January, and the very first buds were beginning early in the month of January. Most of them are coming into their full bloom right now. Bees are thrilled because these are blooming before the almonds are in bloom, and the bee boxes are out in the orchard, so they're all over whatever is blooming. Flowering quince is a great one. I always want to mention, many of the flowering quince will set fruit. It's a rock hard fruit like a quince, so you have to cook it down, but it has a very aromatic, very flavorful fruit. If you happen to have a flowering quince, it happens to set fruit, take the time to make jam from it sometime and you'll be amazed by the flavor and the aroma.
So there's a lot of other pictures here that listeners will enjoy seeing. I have one that I just love this one. It looks like a pansy, but Don said it's not. It's a viola.
Yeah, this is one of the new violas that are large flowered. So they're basically the size of a small pansy. Viola, the sorbet series, and the cultivar name on this one is Morpho. So it's Viola Sorbet Morpho. And it's a cool blend of yellow and almost brown and purple. What I like about this, you notice that there's water droplets all over this picture, right?
Yeah.
So this picture was taken in a break in the rain, and our pansy.
It's beautiful.
And there's no mold going on it. There's no spots on the petals. There's no botrytis causing the flowers to mold. Unlike the pansies, my experience has been violas in general, even the large flowered, newer large flowered violas, take the weather way better than pansies do. To me, pansies are one of the great winter flowers, but if they get a storm while they're standing up, they fall face down in the mud. If they're out there and it rains and it's a little warmer than average, you get that gray mold on the flowers. They're a hassle from a retail standpoint because we have to be grooming them and deadheading them all the time. Violas are great. They just hold their flowers up, the droplets form on the petals and fall right off. So they're really quite lovely. And this Morpho is a fascinating color blend.
So I want the listeners to go and see all of your pictures. And if you go back 2 weeks ago, you'll find something that looks like a raccoon. Click on it, and you'll find that there's actually four pictures in this little series. Yes. There's a raccoon. You click to the next one. Oh, there's two raccoons. Then the next one, third one has joined them. And the next one, there's four raccoon faces gazing into Don's house. It's amazing. Anyway, I hope you all have fun listening. I mean, looking at all these pictures. There's beautiful, beautiful pictures.
Yeah, the raccoons came up to the same door that the fox always comes up to. And then a couple nights ago, I looked out there. There was a giant possum standing there staring at me. I can never leave this sliding glass door open. There's no way. They'll just stroll right into the room. In fact, they have at times. So I'm running a timeshare for wildlife, apparently, here in Solano County. Okay, next topic.
Okay, so we don't have a lot of time left, but I want you please to summarize your pruning advice. And we've talked about that a lot, but just give us a quickie, please.
Yeah, I have had a customer who brought me a bunch of pictures of his fruit trees before pruning and then brought them after. And he said, maybe you could go over this with me real quickly because I feel uncomfortable. Don't know if I did it right. Seems like I pruned these really hard. And he was showing me a picture of his nectarine. So bottom line, peaches and nectarines, we do prune hard. If you don't prune them to remove 50 to 75% of the fruiting wood, you'll get too much fruit and the branches will break. So overall, peaches and nectarines, which fruit on new wood, but grew last year, that wood is red. It's very visibly different than the other wood. You have to remove about half of it and head back about half of it. So we would always warn people when we had a pruning crew, your peaches and nectarines are going to look very pruned when we get done. We're going to be pruning them like a giant bush, really, because otherwise they will fall apart from the excess fruit. Yes, of course, you can manage that fruit load by going out and thinning out the fruit yourself. I don't know anybody who really does that the way they should. So pruning can be your best method of managing fruit load. All the others, the spur fruiting trees, which is plums, apricots, pluots, apriums, apples, pears, cherries, all fruit on spurs. So we don't have to prune them as severely. Our main goal with those is size control of the tree. Yes, we do thin some and we try to get them more open to get better airflow to reduce disease problems. But peaches and nectarines, hard pruning, significant reduction of fruit load. All the others, primarily our concern is tree size. That's the elevator speech on pruning. The next question usually is, but what about citrus? And I say, we generally don't prune them in freezing weather. So we'll talk more about pruning citrus as we get into spring and summer.
Is it okay to fertilize plants during the winter?
It depends on what they are.
Talking about outside plants.
Yeah, people are coming in buying fertilizers for their citrus, for example. If it's an organic fertilizer, it has to go through several steps before the plant can take it up. And it will start that process whenever you put it on. The rate at which it breaks down from the organic source into the next source, into the next source, into the one that's actually taken up by plant roots, depends on the temperature, soil moisture, and soil bacterial activity. So it'll be more slowly available nitrogen if you apply it in the wintertime, but it'll be there when the plant needs it. So as long as you don't get, I don't know, 2 inches of rain in one day, it'll probably be where it needs to be. You can put organic fertilizers on in February. They'll slowly start breaking down. They'll ultimately be in the nitrate form of nitrogen in, let's say, 4 to 6 weeks, probably at this time of year. I'm just guessing based on tables that I've seen, which would put you right about mid-March, which is when root growth activity is certainly happening and new growth is beginning. So it doesn't hurt as long as it isn't going to wash away. Conventional sources, which are already halfway there in terms of what plants can take up, they tend to be either urea, ammonia, or nitrate, but often just urea or ammonia. It only takes them a couple weeks in warm soil, but they're also more soluble. And so if we get 2 inches of rain, they'll either move down past the roots or run off and either become pollution or go feed some other plant. And that's not harmful, but you just wasted your time. So organic fertilizers can really be put on almost any time. They'll just release to the plant more quickly when the soil is warmer. And then the only other issue is if we get so much rain all at once that soil runs off, it might carry those organic fertilizers with it, which would be unfortunate. That doesn't happen here very often. There's absolutely nothing wrong with fertilizing now, especially if you're using an organic-based fertilizer. I don't know, citrus growers generally fertilize their groves in late winter nowadays, at least from the the recommended practices that I've been reading, because they have found that late winter applications of relatively fast acting sources of nitrogen work quite well. Late winter, meaning late February, early March, is when they're often out there applying it. And they have found that if they do it then, the plants take it up very quickly. They can use significantly less nitrogen than they were using before and still get the same growth and yield that they were getting. So it significantly reduces pollution in citrus orchards where they were having problems with heavy soil applications of fertilizer ending up, you know, some of the nitrogen ending up in the groundwater or running off into the drainage channels. You don't want that. So they're adopting practices to get the same results with less nitrogen and timing the application carefully late winter. Late winter meaning end of February, basically early March. So that does work.
So the person who asked this question about fertilizing plants in the winter, from everything you said, it sounds to me like you could do it, mm-hmm. but you'd be smarter just to wait a month.
Yeah, especially if you're using a conventional or synthetic a form of fertilizer. And the other question he asked was, why doesn't nitrogen stimulate growth? Because that's what you'll always read. When you learn about the big macronutrients in any fertilizer, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, each one has a different role that it plays in plant growth. Nitrogen is very important in plant growth. It's a component of proteins, and so it's a crucial part of the development of the plant. But it doesn't literally stimulate growth. That's a genetic thing. Weather stimulates growth. It sustains growth once it begins. It's a more accurate way to put it. Yes, I know a lot of the texts and extension publications will talk about nitrogen stimulating growth. It doesn't trigger the plant to grow. It just has to be there or needs to be there in the plant or in the soil when the plant begins to grow. That'd be it's a more passive process. Let's put it that way. It's just as
it sounds like breakfast.
Right.
So if you offer me breakfast when I'm up and I'm around and I'm, oh, yeah, I'll have some breakfast. But if I'm asleep and you offer me breakfast, I'm not going to do a darn thing.
Interesting analogy. Yes. Well, we get into this more with phosphorus. That's the middle number on the fertilizer, which there are so many claims about phosphorus that are not accurate because it isn't phrased right. Phosphorus is an integral part of the energy transfer process of plants. It's really, really important in all of that. And it's integrated in root development and flowering and all that kind of thing. It doesn't stimulate those things. That's genetic. That's just the plant's genetics that cause it to bloom. If it doesn't have sufficient phosphorus in the plant or in the root zone to take up into the plant as it's beginning to bloom, it won't bloom as well. So if you have a deficiency of phosphorus, you probably should apply some. The only way you'll know if you have a deficiency of phosphorus is having a soil test done. I would repeat, as I've said many times, I've never seen a soil test in our area that indicated a deficiency of phosphorus. If anything, it's almost always very high, like at the highest level the bar chart will go. So applying more isn't going to do any good. It's not like drink more caffeine, you'll be zippier. No, it doesn't work that way. They need a base level. And if they don't have that, you would have a deficiency, but you're only needing to correct the deficiency. It doesn't stimulate bloom, contrary to what everything you've read over decades suggests.
And I want to repeat what Don has told us so many times on the show, that it's usually the roots being unable to take up some nutrient or mineral or whatever that leads people to think they have a deficiency. They don't necessarily have anything wrong with the soil. It's just their roots are damaged.
Well, phosphorus is a good example. If it's cold, the roots don't take up phosphorus as readily. It's also not as mobile within the plant. So the plant will show an apparent phosphorus deficiency, which in the case of something like star jasmine, the leaves turn more purplish. That's a phosphorus deficiency. Many plants will show a purple discoloration to the leaves in the case of a phosphorus deficiency. It doesn't mean the soil doesn't have enough phosphorus. It means it's just too cold for the plant to take it up, or it isn't sufficiently mobile within the plant. So that's self-correcting when the temperature goes up. But if you're a savvy nursery person and you say, oh, look, this plant appears to be deficient in phosphorus, apply this and it will green back up. Hey, look, it magically did. Why? Because the temperature went up. Uh-huh. We're not sure where the notion that it stimulates bloom or stimulates root growth or makes plants more hardy. That's one of my favorite ones, that phosphorus somehow promotes those things. A deficiency would be a problem, which you would correct. The only way to know if you have a deficiency is with a soil test. It can be very interesting to do, but I can tell you, I've never seen a soil deficiency in phosphorus here. If you're doing hydroponic cultivation of certain crop plants, you would definitely need to provide phosphorus, and you already know that.
from a young person, that's a person who's between a child and a teenager.
Yes.
Do you have something on your seed rack that's easy to grow now?
Nasturtiums. One of my favorites.
And then you can eat them.
Yeah, you can eat them if you want to. They're actually, they're really easy to grow. A lot of people in coastal areas are probably wondering why we would even mention them. Don't those run all over your yard? Yeah, they do. Here, it's a great plant for the spring and fall. It's extremely easy to germinate. I would do them in a pot, not right out in the freezing weather, but they'd be very easy in a container right up near the house. May take a couple weeks to germinate, but they'll come up. The foliage is cool. You put them in light shade in our area, they look good through the summer. If you put them in full sun, they'll grow fine in the spring and bloom, but when we get our summer heat, they'll look rather rough. They'll make it through and they'll come back in the fall and look good again. But my experience is the best nasturtiums in the valley are where they're in the light shade of a deciduous tree. And in that situation, they will sprawl, they will run onto things. If you do the old-fashioned kind, they'll bloom in the cooler weather. The foliage is very cool looking. Almost nothing eats them. There's very few pest problems on nasturtiums. And if you don't have room, there's some super dwarf ones that are actually really cool in a way. They're these funny little plants that have as many flowers as leaves, and they only get like one by one. So you can do them in containers. Great to have in a barrel where you might have, let's say, a Meyer lemon in a barrel, and you want something around the base that looks pretty. You could do these little bush-type nasturtiums. So they're very easy from seed.
And there are lots of different colors on the nasturtiums. And you, I never knew about those bush nasturtiums. Mine are all runners. But yeah. I assume if you go out to the seed rack, you'll find lots of different choices there.
Mostly the bush types, actually. Those have become very popular on the seed rack. So if you want the old-fashioned type that do run, you kind of have to look around for those. But the Phoenix series of nasturtium is just beautiful. And that's a plant that will grow 6 to 8 feet from a single plant, sprawling all over the place. Very cool plants.
Well, we always give you a garden quote at the end of the show. This time I found one which is actually a chart. And the question at the top is, should I plant a garden? And you know how on flow charts you get the yes and the no's.
Yes.
Here we go. Have you planted a garden before? If yes, great, dig in. If no, well, it doesn't matter. And both of those lead to the next question, which is, do you have any horticultural training? Yes, good. You can help the rest of us. And if it's no, that doesn't matter either. Both of those lead to the next question. Do you have a green thumb? If the answer is yes, so why are you reading flowcharts? Get outside and start. But if the answer is no to having a green thumb, look, the truth is, it's more important for your hands to be dirty, not green. In the garden, everyone learns by doing, and that's the fun of it. So get outside and start planting.
I want to back up to one sentence, which is, I think, the nutshell. It's more important for your hands to be dirty than to be green.
That's true.
If you go to redwoodbarn.com, I wrote an article probably 20 years ago, if I were planting a garden for the very first time. You'll find it at redwoodbarn.com. Maybe we'll read part of it in an upcoming show as we get closer to the vegetable planting season. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.